Okay, good morning, everybody. We've got 5:31. And it's November 14th. Practicum starts this week. And that means next week is your next lecture test. So that will be on Monday. It'll be on Monday. Okay, I guess that's still working. Vascular system is not on the test. I think the test stops at heart, right? So it's nervous system. Got a couple chapters, maybe three chapters of nervous system, and then heart for the test. And that's it. So vascular system will be on the fifth and last exam coming up during finals week. All right, so on the slide on the left, slide on the left, you see some typical kinds of blood vessels. All right, so what do you call a blood vessel that carries blood away from the heart? That's an artery. And can it have deoxygenated blood? Can an artery have deoxygenated blood? Sure. Give me an example. The pulmonary artery, right? All right, so you have a blood vessel that takes blood away from the heart. You should know its histology. You should know the layers. All right, and then what's the name of a blood vessel that brings blood back to the heart? That's a vein. Give me an example of a vein that is high in oxygen. The pulmonary veins. That's right. The pulmonary circulation is the opposite of the systemic circulation. All right. And tell me a big difference between an artery and a vein. What's one big structural difference between an artery and a vein? Arteries are much stronger. They have a lot more smooth muscle. Veins can vasoconstrict and vasodilate, but they don't need to be very strong because the pressure inside a vein is very low. But that also means that blood can go backwards and forwards in a vein pretty easily. So what's another structure that a vein has that an artery does not have? Valves. Yeah, don't forget about these valves right here. Okay. And what's the name of a blood vessel where exchange can take place? Capillaries. Why is that? Why can exchange only take place in a capillary but not an artery or a vein? Because it has to do with the structure of these blood vessels. What's the structural feature of a capillary that allows for exchange? It's a very thin blood vessel, right? It only has a simple squamous epithelium, but since it's lining this tube, we call it an endothelium, so exchange takes place in capillaries. And as you go from an artery to a vein, how many capillary beds in a typical circulation do you go across? How many capillary beds do you see in this diagram right here? I just see one, right? So this is the kind of circulatory pattern that you see 99.9%, maybe 99.9999% of the time in your body. You have an artery, a capillary, and then a vein. And that completes the circulatory system. There are a few places, if you look at the slide on the right, and we've learned about these already, there are portal systems, right, where you have, let me pull that up, where you have there it is. Okay. A portal system is a blood vessel that connects two capillary beds back to back without going to the heart. So here you have an artery taking blood away from the heart. Here you have a vein bringing blood back to the heart. But in this kind of circulatory system, namely a portal system, you have two capillary beds back to back. This is a special delivery system. So for instance, you can have toxins absorbed in this first capillary bed around the digestive tract. So anything that you eat or drink, right, has a tendency to be absorbed. And instead of dumping this blood back into the regular systemic circulation and then have these toxins go all over the body, this portal vessel is bringing blood from the digestive organs to the liver, where there is a second capillary bed. These toxins can leave, and the cells of the liver then can detoxify these compounds before they can have a deleterious effect on your body. All right, so this is a special delivery system. And then you have the hepatic vein bringing blood to the inferior vena cava and the inferior vena cava back to the heart. Now, where did we first see this kind of circulatory pattern? Yeah, the pituitary gland, right? The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vessel between this particular case, the first capillary bed would be in the hypothalamus, The second capillary bed would be in the anterior pituitary. So that was a special delivery system where releasing factors were absorbed by the hypothalamus and directly delivered to the anterior pituitary. So the hypothalamus doesn't have to synthesize, right, large quantities of those small, those little tiny hormones, because they're not diluted in the whole circulatory system. They're directly delivered to the anterior pituitary. So let's look at the slide on the right. All right, so in the gastrointestinal tract, you have capillaries, which absorb whatever in your digestive tract. So you have the gastric vein, superior mesenteric, inferior mesenteric, and splenic vein, all drain blood from these organs right here that would normally go into these inferior vena cava and then directly back to the heart. But since these veins might contain toxins to your body, right, your body has a different plan for them. This blood, right, gets dumped into the hepatic portal vein. The anastomos form the hepatic portal vein. The hepatic portal vein takes blood to the liver, where there is the second capillary bed, where toxins leave the blood into the liver, and then the liver detoxifies those compounds. Blood then leaves the liver via hepatic veins, which empty into the inferior vena cava, which takes it back to the right atrium. All right, so this is a typical portal system right here. So make sure you know the hepatic portal system and also be able to relate it to the hypothalamo hypophyseal portal system as well. And why is it different than a typical kind of circulatory pattern? You should be aware of that. Okay, then the last topic for today is fetal circulation. But we go over this in lab quite a bit, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time, but I'll give you just a little bit of an orientation. So the fetus is an individual who hasn't been born yet, right? So they're in utero. What kind of organs is a fetus not using? Lungs. That's pretty obvious, right? So they're not breathing air. They just have amniotic fluid. Amniotic fluid does not have a lot of oxygen, so they can't absorb a lot of oxygen in their lungs, even if they were to inhale and exhale amniotic fluid. All right, the second organ is the liver. The fetal liver is not very well advanced, and so these two organs, right, the baby still needs oxygen and still needs liver function. Who's performing the function for the fetus? Yeah, the maternal liver and the maternal lungs, right, the mom's lungs are oxygenating blood, and the fetus, right, has access to the maternal blood supply via the placenta. Right, so the placenta is part fetal tissue, part maternal tissue, and it is acting like the lungs in the fetus, and it's acting like the liver in the fetus. So blood has to go to the placenta, and blood going to the placenta, what are we going to name a blood vessel that goes to the placenta? Right, it's coming away, it's coming from the heart, so it's an artery. And so it's going to go through the umbilical cord. So we call that these are the umbilical arteries. And you can see that it's relatively low in oxygen, but that's okay because why is it going to the placenta? To pick up oxygen, right? So you should think of the fetal circulation like the pulmonary circulation in the adult. So the umbilical arteries are low in oxygen. There are capillaries in the placenta that allow for exchange. Blood then returns back to the fetus via the umbilical vein. Now, what's the state of blood in the umbilical vein since it's leaving the placenta? It's high in oxygen, so it's nice bright red color. All right, so these things mostly go away, okay, in the adult. So there's no counterpart to the placenta, right? That's just lost in delivery. All right, the umbilical arteries become the medial umbilical ligaments in the adult, so they close off. Right, and just become ligaments. This right here, right, the umbilical vein becomes the ligamentum teres that you can see in the liver. So it just becomes a ligament. It no longer carries blood. And since the fetal liver really isn't performing much work, the blood doesn't really need to go through the liver. It takes a little bypass into the inferior vena cava right here, which we call the ductus venosus. And then as soon as you're born, that ductus venosus should close off, or very soon thereafter, and the liver should start to function for the newborn baby, and the ductus venosus then becomes the ligamentum venosum inside the liver. Right, so blood shouldn't go, should not bypass the liver anymore, should actually perfuse the liver. All right, then blood goes up from the inferior vena cava. Where does blood go after inferior vena cava? We drew it on the board last time. Make sure you can draw that out for the test on Monday, week from today. All right, inferior vena cava goes to what part of the heart? Right atrium. Okay, and then normally into the right ventricle, and from the right ventricle where? The pulmonary circulation goes to the lungs. But in the fetus, should there be a lot of blood going from the right ventricle through the lungs? Not necessarily, because there's no oxygen in the lungs. So there are two modifications. The first modification, there's a hole in the interatrial septum. What's the name for a hole in anatomy? A foramen, right? So this is the foramen ovale in the interatrial septum. So I can't really see it on this diagram, but I can see this arrow right here. Let me zoom into this arrow. I see this arrow right here coming from the right atrium. So blood will be shunted from the right atrium into the left atrium, bypassing the lungs through the foramen ovale. And then when you're born, the foramen ovale closes off and becomes just a depression that we call the fossa ovalis, okay, in most people, not everybody. And as a matter of fact, some people live a really long time with it partially open, okay. But once you get past 50, it's got to be closed if there's a little leak there, because the heart's going to fail on you otherwise. So you can live for a really long time before you even know that you have kind of a heart defect. All right, but if blood doesn't go from right to left atrium through the foramen ovale, it gets into the right ventricle, pumps into the pulmonary trunk. It would go to the lungs, except that here is another little patent blood vessel called the ductus arteriosus, which shunts blood away from the lungs, from the pulmonary trunk into the aorta directly. And then when you're born, this blood vessel closes off and becomes a ligament as well that we call the ligamentum arteriosum. All right, so those are the major differences between the fetal and adult circulations. All right, so be able to trace those around. It's not too hard to appreciate as long as you realize that the placenta is doing the job of the lungs. Right, so it's kind of like a pulmonary circulation in the adult. It's opposite compared to the systemic circulation. All right, so that's it for blood vessels. Anybody have a question on blood vessels, portal system, that kind of stuff? Not really. Good. Okay, let's move on to the next chapter. And for you guys, what do we got? Lymphatic system? I believe is it. All right, let me zoom just a little bit so that you can see it a little bit better. Lymphatic system. Okay, so lymphatic system is part of the circulatory system. All right, so in the circulatory system or the cardiovascular system, you've got arteries, veins, the heart, and then you have lymphatic system. So you might realize then that the lymphatic system has a bunch of vessels. All right, but since they're not blood vessels, they're lymphatic vessels, guess what they don't carry? What was the question? Okay. Okay, I hear some talking back up there. So you guys are going to talk, go step outside, okay, so that everybody can hear me. You too, back there. I don't want to say your names out loud because I'm recording. Somebody poke them. Shh. Okay, go outside if you guys are going to talk, okay? Okay, since they're not blood vessels, they don't carry blood, they carry lymph, right, which is a part of blood. It's the fluid part of blood without the cellular components. It doesn't have white blood cells or red blood cells. All right, so here is a component of the lymphatic system. It has a fluid, which we call lymph. It's got some lymphocytes, all right, which is a white kind of white blood cell that fights infection in our body. Lymph vessels that carry lymph back to the heart. And as lymph is flowing back to the heart, it's got to flow through a lymph node. And the job of a lymph node is to filter lymph of maybe cancer cells or bacteria or viruses or other kinds of cells that don't belong in lymph. And then we have some lymphatic tissues that fight infection. For instance, tonsils. that are in your pharynx, okay, and in your mouth, the spleen, right, which is next to your stomach, and thymus gland. Where is the thymus gland? I like to pick on this one a lot. Could have been on your first test. Where is the thymus gland? What cavity is it in? You're pointing to it, but you're searching for the name. What's the name of that cavity? Thoracic cavity is close. It's a subdivision of the thoracic cavity. You could say the ventral body cavity. You would be right, but I want to be more specific. So more than just ventral cavity, what's smaller? Okay, thoracic is smaller, but what's even better? What's smaller than thoracic cavity? Somebody said mediastinum. That's right. So the thymus gland is in the superior mediastinum. Okay, and its job is to help fight infection. All right, so let's look at some functions of the lymphatic system. As a matter of fact, and while I'm talking about it, maybe I'll just put on the other slide a whole picture of the lymphatic system that shows all of the organs, most of the organs. No, that's just the lymph vessels. Okay, here are some other lymphatic organs, and here's the thymus and the superior mediastinum. Okay, so let's talk about function. Maintains fluid balance. So besides fighting infection, it maintains fluid balance. About 30 liters of plasma pass out of capillaries every day. You have, the total circulatory volume is about 5 liters. So we have 5 liters of blood in our bodies. 30 liters pass out of the cardiovascular system all day long and filter through interstitial spaces or extracellular spaces, bringing oxygen and nutrients and washing away toxins and carrying CO2 out of the body. All right, and of course you'd quickly dehydrate if you lost those 30 liters from your cardiovascular system. So 27 gets resorbed at the distal end of the capillary. All right, so 30 liters leave and 27 get resorbed. We can see if we subtract these two numbers, we don't end up with zero. All right, so what's the number that we're left up with? What number are we left with? Yeah, so we're left with 3 liters of fluid that gets stuck in our body, don't get returned to the cardiovascular system. So what the heck is a liter? Who's got a liter bottle? Anybody have a liter bottle? Something? Yeah, this is a lot smaller than a liter. Okay, there's one up there. There's about a liter. Okay. And so 3 of those bottles would get trapped in your body every day, right? So you get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger if it stayed in your tissue spaces, and eventually you just explode in a big mess. But that doesn't happen because these 3 liters that are left in the tissue spaces get resorbed by these auxiliary vessels we call lymphatic vessels. All right, so let's take a look at maybe a lymphatic vessel. What does a lymph vessel look like? This is the beginning of a lymphatic vessel. It's just a little dead-end capillary, and since it's a capillary, it's a site for exchange. Okay, so fluid that enters the space and then it's returned toward the heart. All right, so we don't get filled up with fluid. We would call that edema. Second function of the lymphatic system is that when we eat something, various nutrients are absorbed by capillaries in the small intestine. Sugars and proteins, amino acids, vitamins, and things of that nature. But lipids are not absorbed by capillaries because it would plug your cardiovascular system up. Fats are absorbed by special lymphatic vessels, special lymphatic capillaries that we call lacteals. We see those in the small intestine. And in the next couple chapters, I'll show you where those are exactly. Okay? So that if you have fat and lymph mixed together in a lacteal, we call that chyle, and it's a milky white kind of fluid. And then that lymph travels up, the fat gets processed into special little transport globules, and then it enters the cardiovascular system up near the heart. All right, third function is that it's the body's defense mechanism. Lymph nodes filter lymph, and the spleen filters lymph. It also filters blood. And these organs right here contain lymphocytes, and lymphocytes fight infection by two different means, because of a couple different kinds of lymphocytes. There are B lymphocytes that produce antibodies. Antibodies are little chemical compounds dissolved in the blood that can attach themselves to invading cells and destroy them. And then there are T lymphocytes, which are contact killers, right? When a T lymphocyte bumps into a cell that it knows doesn't belong in your body, it will secrete compounds that dissolve the plasma membrane, and then the cell lyses or breaks apart, and then, of course, it can't be a viable cell after that point in time. And you have these kinds of tissues all over your body, not just in lymphatic organs, okay, but in special little places called mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue, or MALT. So lymphatic tissue is associated with any place in your body where you have a mucosa. And a mucosa is a lining, for instance, maybe of your mouth, okay, digestive tract, and various places. All right, so lymphatic tissue is connective tissue. It's a very loose kind of connective tissue we call reticular. Remember, that's the weakest kind of filament, right? And it just acts as a little matrix to house lymphocytes. Okay, so we find this tissue throughout the digestive tract, throughout the respiratory, urinary, and reproductive tracts. And these things contain germinal centers. All right, let's look at this word. Let's analyze this word, germinal center. What does it mean to germinate? Maybe you know this from more botany or from plants than you do from understanding something about animals or zoology. What does it mean to germinate? What does it mean to germinate? You have a little seed that's dormant, and you place it in some moist soil, what's going to happen to that seed? It's going to start to sprout a root and a stem and some leaves and things like that. We call that germination. So germination means something is going to start to grow. So germination is starting to grow. And these lymphatic tissues can be stimulated into growing. And under what kinds of conditions do you think your immune system is going to be stimulated into growing? When it's being challenged, all right, or when your body is presented with an infectious agent, like a bacteria or virus, your immune system is going to grow to fight that infection. So think of that as being a process of mitosis or proliferation, where you have one cell at one point in time, and then you have two, and then four, and then eight, and 16, and then very soon, early on, you have this whole army of cells that can fight infection for you. That happens in these germinal centers. The things that can stimulate germinal centers are what we call antigens. And these are going to be from foreign substances or infectious agents that enter your body. All right, so I'll talk more about that a little bit later in the class. Lymphatic vessels carry lymph away from tissues. Right, it begins as lymph capillary. So here is a nice micrograph, actually just an illustration of a lymph capillary. It's just a dead-end tube, and here's the lumen of that tube that's going to carry tissue fluid, extracellular fluid. Once that extracellular fluid enters a lymphatic capillary, then we call it lymph. Right, and it has these little flap-like mini-valves right here that are opening and closing because you're moving your body constantly, and different parts of your body will pull on these valves to open it up, and then they'll imbibe extracellular fluid and then push it on its way toward the heart. So lymph capillaries and join together to form lymph-like veins. Let's see what we have for lymph-like veins. Okay, so here is a picture of the lymphatic system. Each of these body regions has lymphatic capillaries, and then lymph is going to find its way. It's going to be drawn back up toward the heart. And what do we call the veins? Right, that are underneath the clavicles, okay, that is draining blood back to the heart. The subclavian veins, right? So the lymphatic vessels then empty lymph into these subclavian veins so that your cardiovascular system doesn't run out of fluid as a result of that. The lymphatic vessels are similar to veins because they have special structures that prevent retrograde flow of lymph, say from a shoulder back down to the elbow or back down to these fingers right here. What do veins have that prevent retrograde flow? valves, yeah. So lymphatic vessels and circulatory system veins are very similar in that respect. And that is that they're very low pressure and there are veins to prevent retrograde flow. Lymphatic vessels do have smooth muscle that can vasoconstrict, which pressurizes the lymph that's in this segment right here. And when this segment gets pressurized, which way does lymph flow? Can it flow back down or does it flow up? It flows up back to the heart because of those veins. Also, when we breathe in and out, there are pressure changes in the thoracic cavity. Right? When we breathe in, it means that the pressure inside the thoracic cavity is very low. Not only does it draw air into the lungs, when pressure is low inside the thorax, it also draws lymph from the extremities into the thoracic cavity. Right? So whenever there's a low pressure in the thoracic cavity, maybe as a result of motion of the diaphragm right here, not only is air drawn into the lungs, but lymph is drawn back toward the heart as well. Sometimes we call that a respiratory pump. Okay. There's a little asymmetry with the lymphatic system. The first organ that we looked at some asymmetry was the heart. Is the heart right smack in the middle of your body? No, it's mostly on what side? It's mostly on the left side of your body. Well, there's even more asymmetry with the lymphatic system. The right lymphatic duct. Let's see if I can find the right lymphatic duct. Okay. Here it is, right here. So here is the right lymphatic duct. The right lymphatic duct drains lymph from the right side of your head, the right side of the thorax, and the right upper appendage. Right? And it goes back and is emptied into the right subclavian vein, right here. While the thoracic duct, here's the thoracic duct, it's huge, it drains blood from the complete left side of the body, right? The head and the thorax and the right upper appendage, right? And the trunk and the lower right appendage, but also the left lower appendage and the lower left abdominal and pelvic cavities, right? So there's a lot of asymmetry. Therefore, you can see that the thoracic duct right here is a lot bigger compared to the right lymphatic duct, which is right over here. Okay, some other structures that I see, the cisterna chyli right here is just a collecting basin for the thoracic duct for everything below this region. That's like at the region of the umbilicus right here. And the other thing that I noticed is that there are nodes situated every so often, and these are what we call lymph nodes. There are some superficial aggregations of lymph nodes in the cervical region, an axillary region, an inguinal region right here. These are very superficial, and sometimes maybe when you go and see a physician and you have a temperature, maybe a sore throat, and they actually palpate these regions. What are they actually feeling for? Enlarged or swollen lymph nodes. Because these lymph nodes are also germinal centers. What do they do when you have an infection? They start to grow and produce lymphocytes that can fight an infection, right? So they get swollen and maybe they're a little bit painful. So that's one way to tell what the extent of an infection is, right? If it's systemic, for instance, if these lymph nodes are swollen all over your body, or maybe it's just in the cervical region right here if you have a sore throat. Okay, so that's one way for a physician to tell what the extent of an infection is. All right, so microorganisms stimulate lymphocyte cell division. So you could think of that as being mitosis in these germinal centers within lymph nodes, also within tonsils. And we call that immune system activation. So an antigen stimulates these germinal centers into growing to produce antibodies or other kinds of lymphocytes, right? They become activated. And the thing that activates them is what we call an antigen. It's just a molecule that doesn't have the proper shape so that it doesn't fit into the normal shapes of molecules that are inside your body. It has a different shape, so your immune system can recognize cells because of molecules that are on the cell membranes that we call antigens. But they could also be toxins, maybe not part of a cell. They could be venoms from a spider bite, or an insect bite or a snake bite or something like that, those are what we call antigens as well. And your immune system will try to detoxify those things as well. All right, let's look at some other lymph tissues. That's tonsils. And when we get to respiratory system, I'll show you a really nice picture of the tonsils, but you have three sets of tonsils. And in this chapter, unfortunately, I don't have a really good example of where the tonsils are. Here's a pretty good example of tonsils, right, in the pharyngeal region. And the first lab knows what the pharyngeal region is, or the pharynx. Who can remind me? What's a common name for pharynx? It's the throat. Yeah, it's your throat. So it's the back of the oral cavity, back of the nasal cavity, and even behind your Adam's apple over here is the pharynx. All right, so these lymphatic structures right here prevent, usually, microorganisms from infecting your body, right, that can get into your body through your nose and your mouth. So that's what their primary job is. So it protects body against pathogens entering through the nose and the mouth. And these tonsils contain this mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. The first one in the posterior oral cavity is what we call the palatine tonsil. And these, if you look in a mirror, stick your tongue out and say, ah, these are the ones that you can see if you still have them. All right, so they're pretty easy to see. The pharyngeal tonsils are more up in the nasal cavity. You can't see them. Sometimes we call these the adenoids. And lingual tonsils are in the posterior aspects of the tongue, here and here. All right, so all of these fight infection. Now, because their job is to fight infection, it doesn't mean that they can't become infected. What do we call it when you have an infected tonsil? Yeah, that's tonsillitis, right? And these things actually can become chronically infected. They can get an infection that never goes away, all right? And where are these things located again? Where are these located? In your throat, right? And if they're infected in your throat, they can cause a sore throat. And there are some people that get a sore throat every other week or every week, and sometimes it can be really bad, and then you have to miss work. And that just can happen week after week after week after week. And sometimes it's hard to treat those infections with antibiotics, so the infection really never goes away. And if that's the case, guess what a good alternative is? To actually have the tonsils removed. Have a tonsillectomy of the chronically infected tonsils. And in little kids, that's not such a big surgical procedure. They'll probably want to get up and run around maybe the same day and eat some ice cream and things like that. But if you're an adult, it's a much more major procedure because these tonsils are pretty much maybe about as big as the tip of your little finger. All right, so think of somebody scooping out some tissue from some part of your body with the volume of your little finger. Can you imagine what your body's going to feel like the next day? Well, it's going to be really sore and hurt, so that if you have a tonsillectomy as an adult, you get 2 weeks off of work to recuperate, which is a nice long time. All right, so that seems kind of like a gruesome procedure, but it's highly recommended because as soon as you're over that procedure, you know, you might not have a sore throat for a year or 2 years afterwards, and it will completely change your life around. So it's a highly recommended procedure, at least from my standpoint. Of course, you'd have to talk to your ear, nose, and throat doctor to be sure that that would really help you, but it really helps a lot of people, okay, with a tonsillectomy. But you got to plan for it because it will put a crimp in your lifestyle for a couple weeks. Okay, lymph nodes. We saw lymph nodes, small round structures along lymphatic vessels. Lymph passes through at least one node before it empties into a vein. And we saw the inguinal and axillary and cervical regions where they are on the previous slide. And again, it's the function of these things is to filter lymph of pathogens, which can activate the immune system, which is what? Lymphocyte cell division. And there can be macrophages in these lymph nodes, which phagocytize pathogens, and then pieces of these cell walls that are distributed to various parts of your body so that the rest of your immune system can recognize what these antigens really look like. Okay, let's see. Oops, whoa. I do want you to look at a lymph node. So here is an illustration of a lymph node. And there are many lymphatic vessels that enter a node, and here you can see a little valve, lymphatic valve here and here and here. And then lymph percolates through all these little structures, and then it leaves through one or two lymphatic vessels to return to the heart. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't flow through another lymph node someplace along the line. It might actually do that. Okay, so these lymphatic vessels are called afferent because they are entering a lymph node, and these are the efferent lymphatic vessels because they're leaving. Just think of your circulatory system. Okay, the medulla. So the medulla is just a deep part of any kind of organ, and the cortex is a superficial part. So here is the cortex, and then the medulla is deep on the inside. Right here is a little sinus that lymph is flowing through. This is what we call a medullary cord. And then lining the medullary cord are the cells that we call the medullary sinus. And the cortex has trabeculae, has invaginations of the cortex. This is just connective tissue. And these invaginations form follicles. So here's a lymphoid follicle with germinal centers on the inside where these lymphatic cells like to proliferate, okay, to fight infection. So I think this is an exam figure to see that. The spleen, located in the, so right just lateral to the stomach. And this is, it functions to filter blood of old and dying red blood cells, right? It filters blood of pathogens, and it can also activate the immune system in what we call white pulp of the spleen. And the spleen also acts as a reservoir for red blood cells. So for instance, if somebody lacerates a large blood vessel and there is a hemorrhage, then the spleen can then dump a lot of red blood cells, which carry oxygen in your body, into the cardiovascular system to help make up for that hemorrhage. The spleen, just like all lymphatic tissue, is made up of reticular connective tissue. And what can you tell me about reticular fibers? They're weak fibers, right? So any kind of trauma to the abdominal cavity can damage the spleen very easily, and it's highly vascular, right? So if it had collagen, it could hold together a lot better, but since it's just reticular fibers, then it rips those blood vessels, and the spleen hemorrhages. And as a matter of fact, the spleen is so weak that it can't even be sutured back together to stop that bleeding. Because as soon as you place a suture, guess what happens? It even causes a bigger laceration, right? It rips the spleen even more. So then the only way to treat that circumstance is to put a ligature around an artery that's going to that part of the spleen that's bleeding, okay? Cut off the blood supply and then remove that part of the spleen that is damaged and bleeding. Right. So then you lose part of your immune system when that happens, but most people can live a very nice, usual life even after missing a spleen. But you might be susceptible to infections under certain kinds of circumstances. Does anybody have a clue who's at a high risk of infection if you're a normal person? Maybe if you're immunocompromised, you'll be at a high risk for pretty much anything. But for a normal person, what are some... What's one circumstance that you're at a really high rate of infection? So for instance, yeah, I suppose if you have diabetes or anybody that's undergoing any kind of surgical technique, right? So that's something, if somebody's missing a spleen anytime you have surgery, right? Physicians are going to be very interested to make sure that you're treated properly after surgery so you don't get any infections. Or even in particular, if you're having surgery that is placing a prosthesis inside your body, like a hip transplant, right, or anything like that. Anytime some part of some metal or other kind of material is left inside your body, that's always an area that's highly prone to infection. I'm not sure anybody understands exactly why that is. I certainly don't, because for instance, if you're getting a hip transplant, which is made out of metal, right, you can completely make sure that that metal that's being placed in your body is sterile, right, just by heating it up, right? Like if you're going to use a needle to pick out a sliver that's in your fingernail, what would you do with a needle if you're really careful, if you want to make sure you don't infect your finger more? Yeah, just put it on a flame, right, and guaranteed there won't be anything alive on that needle tip, right? And so they could do that with all these metal parts, but it still causes infections, right? So I don't know what that's all about. So somebody's at a higher risk for infection when they get a prosthesis placed in their body if they have a splenectomy beforehand. The thymus gland, okay? The thymus gland is in the mediastinum right here. And this is a place where certain kinds of lymphocytes go, namely the T lymphocytes, to gain what we call immunocompetence, where they learn how to do their jobs to become contact killers against cells that have antigens on them that don't belong in your body. They go to the thymus gland to mature so that they can fight infection all over your body. Okay, so that's it for lymphatic system. Pretty short chapter, but even though it's probably the shortest chapter in your book, it's probably one of the most important organ systems in your body, okay, because it helps fight infection, and there are microorganisms all day long, right, trying to just take advantage of your body, okay, for their own purposes, for growth and reproduction. Let me try to just stop for a second and see if there's anything else that I wanted to mention. No, that's pretty much it. So you can do fine without the spleen, okay, except for a few rare circumstances. There is another lymphatic organ that I didn't mention, that is the appendix right here. And like the tonsils, that can become chronically inflamed or acutely inflamed, right? It contains mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue that can be infected, and we call that appendicitis. And it becomes so infected that it might actually burst, right? And that infected material goes everywhere in the abdominal pelvic cavity. All right, but the best treatment is to have it removed before it bursts, right? And again, you're removing lymphatic tissue from your body, but even after an appendectomy, people don't really notice any kind of compromise in their immune system because, and this is the point that I really wanted to get to, you have lymphatic tissue where in your body? Almost everywhere fighting infection for you. So you can take out a little piece like a spleen or an appendix or a tonsil, and you can still have pretty much a normal life after that. Okay. It's only if you have some kind of systemic, right? If you have a disease process that inhibits the immune system everywhere in your body, do you get into problems, right? Like human immunodeficiency. Disease, like AIDS, for instance. Okay, so that's it for lymphatic tissue. Let me ask you a question about the lymphatic tissue. Let's just say maybe somebody was diagnosed with, let's go to a different figure, breast cancer, right? And breast cancer means that a tumor is starting to grow in the breast, right? But it also has the capability to break away from the site of that tumor formation and move through maybe a nerve or cardiovascular system, or even very commonly through the lymphatic system to a different site of the body. We call that metastasis, right? And then a tumor is going to grow in another part of the body, like the brain or liver, bone, for instance. Okay, so one way, of course, we like to catch these cancers very early and then remove the cancer, ablate the cancer. Right, and during the time of the surgery, the surgeon is going to harvest some lymph nodes, and then a pathologist will look at those lymph nodes to see if there's cancer in the lymph nodes, and if there is, then what? Then you got to remove some more nodes that are a little bit closer to the heart, right? And then trace and see where you can stop removing lymphatic tissue, like these lymph vessels and lymph nodes, hopefully not too far. Right, but after the surgeon removes the lymph nodes, what's going to be a side effect of removing lymph nodes from some part of the body? And this is not just true of breast cancer, but any kind of cancer, maybe colon cancer, prostate cancer, any kind of cancer. And if lymphatic tissue has to be removed, what is going to be a side effect of that particular procedure? Even though it saved a person's life, potentially, what's a side effect? Okay, because think of all the functions of the lymphatic tissue right here. Edema, right? When this lymphatic tissue is removed from some part of the body, that region of the body is going to retain fluid. And when you retain fluid, we call that edema in that part of the body. And that's, you know, just unfortunately the way it goes. And that's what we pay physicians all that money to figure out while they're doing it, right? They have to use their clinical judgment to do what? To remove the harmful effects of something from somebody's body while minimizing the side effects. It's always kind of a balancing act, right? Because you want to remove the cancer without, what, producing more edema in other parts of the body, right? So it's not always just, sorry the pun, it's not always a clear-cut decision. And you have to do it while the patient is right there, anesthetized. So that's pretty tough decisions to make sometimes. Okay. So that kind of reinforces some functions right here. Okay, what's the next chapter? Next chapter. Is it digestive system? Ah, respiratory system. Oh, good. We get to look at some tonsils. All right, so let's get some respiratory system slides. Okay. So functions of the respiratory system. First, to move air in and out of the lungs. We call that ventilation. We don't really call that respiration, but we could, maybe it's a kind of respiration, but let's just call it ventilation, moving air in and out of the lungs. Also, it includes gas exchange between air in the lungs and air in the blood. What kind of structure is necessary to get gases into the blood from air that's inside the lungs? What kind of vascular structure is necessary? What kind of structure? What kind of blood vessel? Artery? Capillary, that's right. So you need a capillary for exchange, right? And also transport of oxygen and CO2 in the blood, important respiratory consideration. And then gas exchange, not in the lungs, but between the blood and tissues, right? Systemic tissues in your body. All right, so let's move on to anatomy. The respiratory tract basically can be broken down into two main regions, an upper respiratory tract and a lower respiratory tract. And we see them on the diagram over here on the left. The upper respiratory tract includes the nasal cavity and the nose and the nostril right here, nasal septum, right? And then the pharynx, right? Right behind the oral cavity is what we call the oropharynx, right posterior to the nasal cavity is the nasopharynx, right? So this is all part of an airway. But when you get down to this blue structure over here, this is the line of demarcation between the upper airway and the lower airway. And the beginning of the lower airway is the larynx. All right, so don't forget, pharynx is what? It's a passageway for both air that we breathe and food that we eat. That's part of the job of the throat. The lower respiratory tract, on the other hand, is just an airway. You should never have food or any other kind of particles in this airway because it could occlude the airway. And is breathing a good thing? I would hope you guys are awake enough to know, yes, breathing is a good thing. It's absolutely necessary, right? And if you have food in this airway right here, you can't ventilate the lungs, right? And that's a fatal circumstance when that happens, right? We would call that choking. All right, so the first part of the lower airway is the larynx. It's got a number of pieces. And then the trachea, we see the trachea bifurcates. After this bifurcation, then we call it a bronchus. And you have a left main bronchus and a right main bronchus. And then it's going to bifurcate again to get to different parts of the lung, right? That's going to be a secondary bronchus, and then it bifurcates again into a tertiary, and then on and on and on until it gets smaller and smaller to where you can't even see it with your naked eye. All right, so let's look at this diagram right here. All right, tell you what, let's look at this one first. All right, so this shows you the pharynx, the three divisions of the pharynx. Posterior to the nasal cavity is the nasopharynx. Here's the oral cavity. Posterior to that is the oral pharynx. And then here is the larynx. And in guys, it's a very prominent structure because it hypertrophies under the influence of testosterone. Vocal cords get really thick and kind of immobile, so our voices are a little bit lower. Posterior to the larynx is the laryngopharynx, right? So this is still a passageway right here for both air and food. And then this is the beginning of the lower respiratory tract, including this little trapdoor right here. Here's a piece of cartilage, and hopefully it kind of looks blue to you because blue will signify cartilage on this diagram. So that when you swallow something, we want it to go into this tube right here, which is posterior to the larynx, and this is the esophagus. This is the tube that's going to take food to the what organ? To the stomach, right? And the larynx is the tube that's going to take air to the lungs, and this is where things get separated out. So when you swallow, the epiglottis flops down over the posterior part of the larynx so that food kind of slips over this region and gets diverted into the esophagus right here. Right, so that's the epiglottis. Here is the voice box. There's some other cartilages right here. This is the thyroid cartilage because on either side of the thyroid cartilage is the thyroid gland. And then here is a ring that completely surrounds just the inferior aspect of the thyroid cartilage. We call this the cricoid cartilage. And then even the trachea has a lot of cartilaginous rings. So the larynx is held open all the time. And the trachea, here are the cartilaginous rings in the trachea. The trachea is held open all the time, as opposed to the esophagus. The esophagus is closed all the time. Unless you're swallowing food, there's a bolus of food coming down. And that means that there are two important clinical ramifications for these two different tubes. They misbehave differently. All right, so let's talk about the larynx and the trachea and how it misbehaves. Well, let's take a little marble and place it right here and let go. What's going to happen to it? It's like shooting pool, right? Pool's a really easy game. All you have to do is get one of these little balls over the pocket, and what happens to it? Usually it just falls right in, right? And that's a good thing. That's how you win the game. But in this particular case, if we put a little particle right here and drop it, what's going to happen? It's going to fall into the airway and occlude the airway, which then can lead to death if that happens, if it occludes the airway. All right, so that's the importance of the epiglottis. It prevents foreign bodies from entering the trachea, usually, but not all the time. This epiglottis gets lazy every once in a while, and there is a day of the week where the epiglottis likes to get lazy, to where when you swallow something, it doesn't close. Now, I know a lot of you are CPR certified in here. You probably know all this stuff. Furthermore, there's a time of that day when the epiglottis gets lazy. So who knows what day and what time during that day does this epiglottis get lazy? Anybody know when that is? So if you're CPR certified, that's when you should kind of be paying attention, because this is a time when most people choke to death. Terrible thing. Okay, turn purple, make all kinds of weird noises. All right. And that day, somebody give me a guess what day?
Sunday.
Sunday. That's pretty close, but that's not the day. The day is Friday. Okay, now what time during Friday?
Happy hour.
Ah, exactly right. So it's usually Friday during happy hour, maybe Saturday, maybe over, you go to the country club or something, and it's associated with what? Adult beverage, right? Adult beverage and having a good time kind of horsing around. So maybe this Friday a bunch of you guys are going to get together, study for the test that's coming up Monday. And you're studying, eating some nachos or popcorn shrimp and sharing a four or five pitchers of beer, and then somebody tells a joke about the anatomy instructor, and just as you're about ready to swallow, you hear that joke, and what happens? You start to laugh just as you're swallowing, so instead of laughing, you go and start to laugh, but where did that food end up? It ends up here in the trachea instead, okay? So just kind of be aware of that, right, when you're eating stuff, that you shouldn't mix up swallowing and breathing at the same time. And that can happen under those circumstances pretty easily. Has anybody ever saved a life in here by performing a Heimlich maneuver and somebody that's choking? Ah, cool. Oh, a lot of people. All right, you guys should come down closer to the front row. Because if you know how to do a Heimlich maneuver, you probably know how to do chest compressions, right, and artificial respiration, all that kind of good stuff to keep somebody alive. That's marvelous. Was it hard to do? You did it for your mom? Oh, wow. Was it hard, in your case, was it hard to to perform a Heimlich maneuver on somebody? It's pretty easy. How many times did you have to do it? Like 3-4 times?
It was on my brother.
It was on your brother. Okay. That's good, yeah. So you probably saved the lives of those people. That's pretty cool. Okay, so you get a foreign body in this trachea because it's what? It's held open all the time. It's easy to get stuff stuck in there. Okay, so that's the job of the epiglottis right here. Well, since we're on this figure, we can see the oral cavity, and then just behind the oral cavity is the oropharynx. There's a nasal cavity. Just behind the nasal cavity is the nasopharynx. Now, here is the opening of the eustachian tube to the middle ear, right? And so that's why now sometimes, instead of calling that the auditory tube or eustachian tube, we call that the pharyngotympanic tube. See, now it probably makes more sense to call it the pharyngotympanic tube, right? Because that's how it's connected up. And then here is a tonsil I promised I'd show you today. So here's a pharyngeal tonsil, right, in the nasal pharynx. And then here's a palatine tonsil in the oral pharynx. That's the one that you can see. This is the one that's most commonly removed, right? And then here is the lingual tonsil on the posterior aspect of the tongue right here. So those are the three kinds of tonsils. So this is a good, this is an excellent exam figure probably. So what else do we see on this diagram? All these things are good. Like here is the sphenoid, paranasal sinus. Here's the cella turcica. What's going to be in the cella turcica right here? What's this right here? What gland is that? Yeah, it's a pituitary gland. And sometimes that turns cancerous or turns into a tumor in some people and starts to over-secrete a lot of hormones. And it's at the base of the brain. But notice how easy it is to get to. All you have to do is go right through the sphenoid bone, maybe right through the sphenoid sinus right there, right? So it's a relatively easy kind of procedure to have this ablated. So here is a nostril. Sometimes we call that a nair. Then there's a little bulge in here that we call the vestibule. And then here are the nasal conchae. You can see the inferior, middle, and superior nasal conchae. These little, which are shelves that help air condition air because they're covered with mucosa. So if you're breathing cold air, it helps warm it up. If you're breathing hot air, it helps cool it down. If you're breathing really dry air, it humidifies it so that you don't turn your lungs into potato chips. And then the meatuses are just passageways above and below the nasal conchae that act as air passageways into the airways below. Okay, hard palate. You should probably remember the names of the bones that make up the hard palate. What's the bone back over here? That's the palatine bone. And then this is the, you can see it right here. That's just the upper jawbone. What's another name for upper jawbone? Maxilla, right? That makes the hard palate. And then here is the soft palate with the uvula. That's that little, almost looks like a little tongue sticking down that people get confused with a tonsil. It's really not a tonsil, but that's the uvula. Right, so that when you swallow something, the soft palate moves and occludes, right, this passageway right here up into the nasal cavity so that food goes down into the esophagus, right? So this is an important area for not just speaking, but also for swallowing. Here is the tongue, the very center of the tongue right here. There's a little connective tissue right here. Called a frenulum, right? And so this would be the lingual frenulum, and if you look on the inside of the lip, that would be the labial frenulum. You can feel those little structures right there. There's one on the superior lip as well, inferior lip. Sometimes the frenulum is adhered to the mouth, okay, and it just is too tightly attached, and then the frenulum then has to be reduced, right, to allow proper motion of the lips right here and tongue, and that's especially important in infants, right, not to have a tethered frenulum. Especially in infants, why is it important for an infant not to have a tethered frenulum? Because if your tongue and lips can't form properly and you can't move them properly, then you can't nurse, right? Then you can't feed yourself. And then, of course, an infant won't ever thrive if that's the case. Okay. Okay, all these other things you're kind of familiar with already. So this is a really good diagram. Here is that thyroid gland, right, just below the larynx. Right, and on either side of the larynx. Okay, lower respiratory tract. Let's look at a nice diagram of the larynx in particular. All right, so this is an important diagram for you to know for both practicum, the fifth practicum, but also the last test. Back over here, you see the hyoid bone. Nice, this is tucked up inside the mandible. So you can see the epiglottis poking up just a little superior to the hyoid bone. This is a trapdoor that prevents entry of food into the larynx and trachea when you're swallowing. All right, so then here is the thyroid cartilage. That's a very prominent Adam's apple in men. Then below that is the cricoid cartilage. And then underneath that are the tracheal cartilages. They keep the trachea open all the time. Ah, I remember a question that I wanted to ask you. Why is it that the larynx and the trachea have these cartilages that keep them open all the time? We see that it's kind of a disadvantage because it allows you to choke, right, which is not a good thing. But why? Why are these airways open all the time? Why is it important? How is it that you move air in and out of your lungs? It's by causing pressure changes, right? So to get air in, you reduce pressure inside your thorax, which is going to have a tendency to expand the larynx and the trachea. If pressure is reduced, these things are going to expand. But how do you get air out of your lungs? You have to compress, and if you were to compress, right, to cause pressure, high pressure inside the thorax, then the larynx and the trachea would actually occlude themselves. And when they compress and shrink down, then air couldn't leave your lungs. So the larynx and trachea have to be held open so that when the thorax undergoes pressure changes, they remain patent or they remain open so that air can pass through them. So that's why they have to have cartilage and why the esophagus does not have to have cartilage, because something shouldn't move from your stomach back up into your mouth, right? It's okay if the esophagus contracts. All right, so here's a nice anterior view. What about a lateral view, posterior view? Okay, here's a nice lateral view. So we see the thyroid cartilage. This is anterior. Here's posterior. So here's the thyroid cartilage. It doesn't completely encircle the larynx like the cricoid cartilage does. The lower cartilage completely rings the larynx. And then here is the epiglottis. That's elastic cartilage. And then we have an arytenoid cartilage and a corniculate, a little one up on the top right here, and these are the ones that can place tension on the vocal folds right here. So there are some muscles that attach to the arytenoid, which then can place tension on the vocal folds, right? It can stretch them, make them really, really tight. What happens when the vocal cord becomes really, really tight? It changes the frequency at which it likes to vibrate at, in which case it's going to vibrate at a high frequency. And when that muscle relaxes, right, then the tension decreases, it will vibrate at a lower frequency. So this is a way that you can change the pitch of your voice. Okay, and it's interesting. I've never known anybody who couldn't do that. I've known a lot of people that can't control the pitch, okay, their pitch when they're singing, for instance, or speaking, but they can change it, they just don't know how it's going to change precisely. All right, superior to the vocal folds or the true vocal cord is a vestibular fold. Sometimes we call that a false vocal cord, and it doesn't extend quite as far into the lumen of the larynx as the vocal fold does. Okay, so that's a bunch of cartilages of the larynx. All right, and then below the cricoid cartilage is the trachea. That's no longer the larynx right here. All right, so When you have a sore throat, what do we call that clinically? What the heck is, where's your throat at again? Here's your throat. When you have an inflammation of the pharynx, we call that a sore throat, right? You can see an inflammation, maybe a tonsil's inflamed too, right? You can see a red pharynx right here. But when you lose your voice, what do we call that? That's what we call, let's look at this one right here. When you lose your voice, that's an inflammation of the larynx. So that's a laryngitis, right? So that will help you remember essentially the difference between a laryngitis and a pharyngitis right here. Two different locations, and obviously it sounds a whole lot different. Okay. And so the trachea is anterior to the esophagus. Oh, it's lined with that really cool epithelium, the pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, right? Just, you should remember what that looks like, loaded with goblet cells. And what's the job of these goblet cells? Oh, do I have a nice picture? I bet I have a picture somewhere. Maybe. Not enough, that's only 13 power magnification. I need much more magnification to see. What's the job of the goblet cells? What do they secrete? Okay, they secrete mucus. All right, so here is the pseudostratified columnar epithelium. Oh, this is probably a goblet cell right here. I can see some mucus in there. And it's a ciliated lining, so this mucus flows over all these cells. And what's the function of these cilia right here? Yeah, it's for motility. It's sweeping this mucus because the mucus is kind of sticky. It attracts dust particles that we breathe in, and so instead of dust plugging up our lungs, okay, it gets trapped on this mucus. And then what do the cilia do? Which way do they sweep it? Down or up? Who has a guess? Up would be really good, because if it swept it down, then your lungs would fill with dirty mucus, right? So it sweeps it up into your oral cavity, and then when it's in your oral cavity, what do you do? Okay, if you're a baseball player, then you got to spit it out. But if you're a normal person in class right now, then you just swallow it down, right? Get it out of your lungs. Okay, so that is the lining of the airways. The cartilaginous rings function. What's the cartilaginous rings function for? What purpose? Keep the airways open so that they don't collapse. All right, posterior segment of the trachea is not cartilage. All right, the posterior segment. Let's look at a cross-section of the trachea. Here I can see a cartilaginous C-shaped ring. Here's the lumen of the trachea, nice pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. All right, but the posterior segment right here has a trachealis muscle. Right, and that's important because just posterior to the trachea is the, anybody remember what this tube is? It's a mouth-to-stomach connection. Esophagus, that's right. So the esophagus is right up against it. So when you swallow food, a big bolus of food is going to transit the esophagus, and the esophagus actually pushes into the trachea to allow passage of food. So if this was a hard ring all the way around, that would occlude the esophagus. So the posterior part of the trachea is just the trachealis muscle that actually indents when a bolus of food passes by it. Okay, so that's it for lecture. We're going to start here someplace next time. Probably with bronchioles or bronchi. And the sign-in sheet is right here if you still need to sign it. And please try to leave the classroom relatively speedily because I got to go to class at noon. Gee, who knows what class do I have at noon today? You guys all took off already. There's a practicum at noon, right? Okay.